Today on Writer's Voice, why does the Democratic Party struggle so much to win elections by comfortable margins when it isn't losing them, despite the fact that the Republicans are so extreme? Could there be a hint in the fact that so many ordinary Americans keep losing ground economically, no matter who holds the reins of power? We talk first with Ed Bermilla about his book Chaotic Neutral, How the Democrats Lost Their Soul in the Center. Then Alyssa Court of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project tells us about her just-released new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Democratic Party claims to be the party of the people. But then why does it actually do so little for the people, even when it's in power? Especially when Republicans are so obviously hostile to the economic interests of ordinary Americans. Ed Bermilla's book, Chaotic Neutral, tracks the devolution of the Democratic Party from the New Deal era to Biden's status quo candidacy and the pandemic, when, even in the midst of a national crisis, the Democrats couldn't pass sweeping progressive legislation. It's a timely analysis that pinpoints why Democratic politicians act like also-rans even when they're in power. Ed Bermilla, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You say right up at the front that Democrats give up when they should fight, that they know how to get things done, and then they spend their time in power explaining what they can't do. And, you know, I thought this was a perfect example of this is recently when they touted, you know, you just hear all over the place how the Democrats allow now the negotiation of drug prices without mentioning that it just works for Medicare recipients for six drugs, won't start for several years, except for the diabetes drugs.
There's a lot of asterisks involved. When you know, it's good for a political party to tout its accomplishments. One of the things that I feel the Democrats legitimately have needed to get better at was saying, here's what we did and here's why it's good. But yeah, as you're pointing out, their love of kind of technocratic policy that has a lot of exceptions and a lot of caveats and a lot of yeah, buts involved, it's often very difficult to communicate to voters what you did when you have to make all those kinds of qualifications and clarifications and exceptions and so on and so forth.
And so talk about how they give up when they should fight. What do you mean by that?
My impetus for writing the book, when most people look for a nonfiction book topic, they look at where there's a gap in the market, what hasn't been written about. And my motivation for writing this book was a lifetime of every 18 months seeing a new book come out about what's wrong with the Democrats. So that, you know, it started me looking at this larger question. I was born in 1978, and starting, you know, from when I was old enough to understand what politics is, it was this constant running conversation. How do we fix the Democrats? And every year or two, someone puts out a new book called, you know, Rebooting the Democratic Party, or how to fix what ails the Democratic Party. And my motivation was really, what's the deeper fundamental problem that allows someone to write this book every year or every 18 months? What are they not addressing, and why are they unable or unwilling to address it so that they keep scratching their heads and saying, gosh, we don't know what's wrong and how to fix it. But they've been doing that for my whole life. So the motivation for the book was to dig another layer deeper and say, what's the underlying problem here? And a big part of the problem, as I see it, is that they made a series of decisions throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s that they were going to focus on a different kind of voter who had different kinds of needs, wants, and demands of the political system. And in their mind, they still see themselves as kind of the Roosevelt-era working-class blue-collar party. But in reality, they've very much become the party of people with graduate degrees, people with a good amount of income and financial security, people who have very different needs and wants from the political system. But at the same time, they're still trying to hang on to their roots as they see it, as like the working class party. So really what they're doing is they're trying to create a liberalism and a politics that appeases everybody. And as you and I know, just from our normal lives, nothing to do with politics, the more you try to please everybody, the more likely you are to end up pleasing very few people.
But when you say please everybody, what you're really talking about in this book, Chaotic Neutral, is how the actual policies that are passed please basically the donor class. I mean, not even just your professional suburban mom, but the people who donate to the party. I call them corporate Democrats. And then the way they try to please their base is by pretending to do something.
They have substituted spectacle for political outcomes. And what they do is they deliver policy outcomes that people on the center right want. And they try to spin that in a way that appeals to what they think of as supposed to be their core constituency of like voters on the left, liberals, whatever you want to call it. And so one part of their constituency is getting the results they want. The other one's getting a lot of pretty speeches and a lot of pretty words, but very little action that produces meaningful, concrete differences in their lives. And that's untenable. You know, and so they're constantly throwing up their hands and saying, gosh, what happened? Why didn't, you know, they turn it onto voters and they scold voters for not turning out or whatever. Well, you know, people get tired of unfulfilled promises after a while. And the, you know, the bottom line argument they make that, well, the Republicans are worse, so you have to vote for us. There's some validity to that. Obviously, the Republicans are terrifying and awful. But at the same time, you can't rely on people's, you know, committed support election after election when you're not delivering the things that they're asking you to do for them.
Now, your moment of truth started, interestingly enough, at the same time my moment of truth started, which was when Obama let Wall Street off the hook. I mean, I remember the moment, I mean, the first appointment he made when he came into office was Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, you know, the guys from the Goldman Sachs party. And it was really at that moment that I understood that his promise, his hope and change promises, were going to come to naught. But a second point for you came on February 28th, 2017. What happened then?
That was something we just experienced not too long ago, which is the State of the Union address, or actually the first address the president gives is an address to a joint session of Congress, not technically State of the Union. But then the out party, the party that doesn't control the White House, gives a response. And we just saw Biden give his State of the Union, and then Sarah Huckabee Sanders gave the Republican response. And the Democratic response that year, right after, you know, the 6 months of emotional shock that had fallen over American liberalism, that Trump managed to win the election, and the response was given by former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. And that might not ring bells with you, but if you remember, or you think back to that era, you might recall an old man sitting in a darkened diner surrounded by people who looked terrified to be there. And he spent 5 or 10 minutes talking about, you know, how he's also a Republican in addition to being a Democrat, and partisanship is not really what's going to save us here, and you're looking forward to working with the new president and everything, just completely detached from reality. And of course, the advantage of something like the response to a State of the Union is that people forget about it very quickly. So that moment didn't stick with me because I thought what Steve Beshear said that night was monumentally important in any way. It stuck with me because this was what they came up with to make the first symbolic attempt to show the rest of the country, hey, look, we're devastated by what happened. You know, nobody expected Trump to win. This is bad for us. It's bad for the country. We're here and we're ready to fight back. Right. Here is our plan. Here's how we're on your side. And, you know, we're going to make sure that the impact of having this lunatic in the White House, you know, that we do our part to shield the American people from it. And instead, they had this just kind of confusing, baffling, really accommodationist sort of attitude toward, you know, how they're looking forward to healing the nation and everything. And it's just, it's so disconnected from reality. And it gave us a snapshot, a kind of peek behind the curtain of what this is, what the you know, the big money consultants in Washington, D.C., who make these kinds of decisions, this is what they think people want to see. And that's a fundamental problem, because their conception of what people respond to and what they want out of their politics is just so far out of, you know, so far removed from reality that I think it speaks to what the real problems the Democratic Party has, not what they perceive as their problem.
The real problems?
Yeah, the real problem is that they're fundamentally afraid to be partisan. They're fundamentally afraid to fight back against the Republican Party. They think that their path forward always involves finding ways to work with the Republicans, because that's what people want to see. They want to see comity and bipartisanship and everybody hugging and getting along. Nobody wants bipartisan policy. They want good policy. If it's not good, it doesn't matter that it's bipartisan. So that was one of the points of departure I used for the book, was to focus on the moments during the Bill Clinton administration in the 90s where bipartisan was elevated and put on a pedestal, because what it really was a way to convince liberals and Democrats that the outcomes they were getting were good, when really what the Clinton administration was doing was throwing up its hands, admitting that the Republican Party was right about most things and just sort of giving them what they wanted. But you have to find some way to present that to your voters as a win. And the way you do that is to eliminate the idea of partisanship as a good thing, where you're fighting for what your party believes in, and make it a negative.
Right. I mean, a perfect example is Social Security and Medicare. You know, it was good to see, I have to say, it was good to see Biden defending Social Security and Medicare. But there was a time when he didn't. There was a time when Obama was willing to sink it. And this also began back in the Clinton era as well. So talk about the attitude on Social Security and Medicare. And do you think that it's changed?
I think they're starting to realize what bad politics it is to join hands with the Republicans and say, yes, we need to, quote unquote, reform this. You know, for years, the Democrats have insisted on wrapping up all talks about changes to Social Security in the language of reform. Cuts sounds bad. Reform sounds good in their cosmology. But I think people hear reform and they know what it means. And the Social Security argument in this country is just so fundamentally unserious. Because we get all these scare pieces about how Social Security is going to run out of money or whatever. Yet the easiest and most obvious and most politically, I think, fair solution is simply to lift the Social Security tax cap. And that's totally off the table. It's not even an option. It's presented as something that's just completely unrealistic. Don't even talk about it. It can never happen. So instead, we're presented with this issue that we're told is just incredibly important and it's looming over us. But one half of the realm of solutions, which would be to increase revenue to the program by lifting the cap, is simply, you know, you get a hand wave and they say, well, you're not a serious person. That can't really, you know, that can't happen. We can only talk about variations of how to cut this, right? Raising the age limit, reducing benefits, all these other things. It's just, how many different ways can we propose cutting this and not look at all at the solutions that would, in fact, be the quickest and easiest solution?
And there is really only one politician that I ever hear making that point, and that is, of course, Bernie Sanders. Sanders, as you point out in this book, Ed Bermilla, and as you point out in Chaotic Neutral, Sanders is a New Deal Democrat. I mean, he's really not a socialist, except in the sense that he believes in working class solidarity. I'll give him that. I'm not so sure he's that keen on rescuing capitalism the way FDR was. But talk about, just very briefly, how did we get from the Democrats being the working class party of FDR that did the New Deal to here, and why?
Well, that's a difficult story to sum up quickly, unfortunately. And one of the struggles that I had with writing this book is how to condense a lot of history change in the Democratic Party into a relatively short, snappy story. But what happened is, in the 1970s, the Democrats made a very conscious decision to do two different things. One of them, they made a conscious decision that they felt that there was a white reactionary segment of the population that was simply rebelling against civil rights. These people could not handle the changes of the civil rights movement. They could not handle the women burgeoning like women's rights or gay rights movements of the 70s. This was repellent. This is the sort of Archie Bunker theory of why the Democratic Party started losing votes. But what's lost in that story, and the point I make in Chaotic Neutral, is that simultaneous to that, they made a conscious decision to tack to the right on economic issues as well. And whenever we look back, you hear people like James Carville tell their version of what happened to the Democratic Party in the 60s and 70s. It always boils down to, well, voters are super racist, and because the Democrats became liberal on civil rights, we drove away a lot of voters, and that's all there is to it. But in reality, what happened is the Democratic Party increasingly started to adopt neoliberal, right-wing, embraced, economic worldview, where markets were the final arbiter of all human interactions. Government was a relic of the past. Big government was bad. Handing things over to the entrepreneurial class and to the markets was the way we were going to solve our problems. So that, I think, is the undertold part of the story. Everybody focuses on what I like to call that Archie Bunker narrative, but nobody really pays a lot of attention to the fact that by the mid-90s, the height of Bill Clinton's popularity when he was reelected in 1996, he had effectively become a second right-wing party on economic issues as well.
And you also point out in the book that, you know, if we fast forward to Trump, that the Trump voters, many of the working class Trump voters, in fact, voted for Obama twice. So what made them go? I mean, and you don't soft pedal the fact that racism and sexism is also a deeply ingrained thread in American politics. But
that's always been the case. It's always been true. Right. It was true when Barack Obama got elected this country did not become a racist country in 2016. We have a long and difficult and brutal history of having problems being a racist country where white supremacist ideas are fundamental to how the majority of the country thinks of itself. And, you know, that's not irrelevant to the story, but it's not the complete story. And people who try to tell you it's the complete story are unwilling to look at what the Democratic Party has done to actively alienate voters, right? Yes, there are some voters who are racist. They hate women. They're simply not going to vote for a Democratic candidate. They're certainly not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, whatever. But to pin the Hillary Clinton loss on that and that alone implies that there's no agency involved, that the candidates have no ability to appeal to voters. They can't possibly overcome these prejudices. Yet, Hillary Clinton, you know, ran in her election on the tail of two victories by Barack Obama. And if, you know, my argument is not that racism is irrelevant, but that if the country really was that irredeemably racist, Barack Obama doesn't win in 2008 by one of the biggest margins in a modern presidential election.
Biggest margins, but then went on, the Democrats went on to lose more than 1,000 seats in state legislatures and around the country, governorships as well. So talk about that aspect, how the emphasis on national versus local and state politics has been part of the problem here.
Well, the Democratic Party does have a myopia when it, everything about Washington, D.C. is what's important. And they really have downplayed, being competitive in state legislative races and winning state and local races. You know, that was always their backbone, their bread and butter as a party. And during the 21st century, they've shifted their focus entirely. You know, the right, as an entity, and the Republican Party in particular, they celebrate victories in state houses because they know that's important. Every time they're able to pass some regressive, reactionary piece of legislation through, the Missouri state capitol or whatever, they know that's a win for the movement. For the Democratic Party, they've way too long have looked at, whatever happens in Jefferson City, Missouri is not important. I've been to Jefferson City and I can understand why people think it's rinky-dink, but, nonetheless, that's a lot of important ground that the left and liberalism have largely ceded to the right. You know, the Republicans began their rise from New Deal era mediocrity by taking over school boards, by running in local election stuff in the 80s. They didn't begin, as many people might, envision the story, with Ronald Reagan won, and then suddenly the world was safe for Republicans. They clawed their way back slowly but surely, focusing on a lot of these lower level races where the application of resources, which they were always very good at raising, could have more of an effect. Right. We can throw another $100 million on the fire of the presidential race in 2024, or we could distribute that $100 million across the country to people running for city councils, where I guarantee you would have a much bigger impact. But the way liberals believe in government regulation of the economy, they look at national solutions to problems, not races they see as comparatively less important. So yeah, there's a huge focus on the Senate, the House, and the presidency. Of course, those things are important, but they're not the only important part of politics.
And the other is the urban-rural divide. I mean, I live in New York State. New York very well may have handed the House of Representatives in the 2022 elections to the GOP. Mm-hmm. And I live on the area, in the area of New York State, one of the two major areas of New York State which helped that to happen. I live on Long Island, and there's also upstate New York. And now these are rural areas that have been completely abandoned by the Democratic Party. Just no organizing at all. Talk a little bit about that division, and why have they abandoned what they call the flyover regions?
Well, I think when their popularity in those areas started to wane and they couldn't come up with a quick and easy way to figure out how to get it back, they couldn't come up with a painless solution, which is just adopt a new slogan or change the way you talk about things. You and I are of an age where we remember very clearly the George W. Bush years, where that George Lakoff-inspired obsession among liberals was just find the right words, right? Find the language that we can use to convince people that our ideas are great. And in reality, you can't just keep putting a new coat of paint on things. You have to listen to people. You have to figure out what they want, and you have to come up with a politics that aims to deliver it to them. And I think a lot of what the Democratic Party as an institution does is sort of outreach toward rural areas is more sort of here's what we want to give you and less of we're listening to what it is that you want. But there is also, I think, a convincing argument to be made at this point that focusing on the plight of rural areas is a right-wing frame. Right. Because if you look at the population breakdown in this country, rural areas are, getting smaller and smaller, smaller part. And to say that those voters, simply by virtue of the fact that they have, more of the map is devoted to rural areas than urban ones, those voters don't necessarily have any right to feel entitled to political preference simply because rural America is, more important or better or whatever than the rest of the country. So I'm hesitant to buy too deeply into that framing.
Yeah, except for the fact that because of the structure of our electoral system, rural areas have an inordinate amount of power. They get an equal amount of representation in the Senate. And, the state legislatures are the basic backbone of our electoral system. And if they go fascist, just to use the F word, then we're not going to have a national politics that's democratic.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they do need to find ways to win those elections. And I think there are some glimmers of hope that they're kind of figuring it out. The Michigan model, since Gretchen Whitmer was elected there, has sparked some interest among the more thoughtful people, among the strategist class and, among liberals and Democrats. I think there's a recognition that they need to find a way to compete in that environment. And what they've been trying to do isn't getting it done. I think they're doing, they would do well to listen to politicians who have had some success winning the kinds of voters Democrats have struggled to try to win for so long. The whole thing with John Fetterman was not, when people talked about the Fetterman campaign, they always tried to reduce it to some kind of symbolism. You know, people like him because he's a big dude and he wears cargo shorts or whatever. People liked John Fetterman because he ran against a very well-funded establishment Democrat in the primary. And his key argument was, look, I'm not going to be an obstructionist. I want to be the 51st vote for everything. When things come to a vote in the Senate, I don't want to be the reason it doesn't pass. And that's tremendously appealing to people. And I think that so much of the coverage of Democrats who did well in 2022, like Mark Kelly, like Fetterman, you know, so much of the coverage has really downplayed their basic affect toward the political process, which I think is what's much more appealing to them than, or, you know, about them than their personalities or how they dress or whatever.
Yeah, I want to get back to that point, but I'd also like to note something that also is not talked about, that Fetterman is in favor of Medicare for all. I mean, his politics was definitely on the progressive end of the spectrum, and you almost never heard about that. And then, so speaking about another politician in this frame, Edward Miller, you write in Chaotic Neutral that the leadership of the Democratic Party tried to take out one of their most faithful, and in terms of the Democratic program, most faithful incumbents, and that was Ed Markey. Ed Markey was something you don't say in the book, but I'm very well aware of. Ed Markey's campaign, I think, was hugely promoted and helped by the Sunrise Movement, by young climate activists who said, you know, this guy is our guy, and we are going to make sure that everybody knows it, and you've got to vote for him.
I mean, you see sort of a glimmer of the same thing happening again this past week. Nancy Pelosi is now working overtime to get Sean Patrick Maloney a job as the Secretary of Labor. You know, Maloney was just defeated in one of the New York congressional races. He was high up in determining strategy for House campaign nationwide for the DCCC and things like that. This is what a lot of this leadership class sees the Democratic Party as, this sort of jobs program for people who are in the club. You know, the idea that we're supposed to care if Neera Tanden gets an appointment, that we're supposed to care, you know, that Sean Patrick Maloney's at loose ends for his career right now or whatever. These people are all fine. They're all very well off. They all have elite educational credentials and connections and everything. They're fine. We don't need to worry about Sean Patrick Maloney. We need to worry about what, as a party, they're getting done with the opportunities they have to get things done, which understandably now are limited by Republican control of the House. But nonetheless, you just want to throw up your hands and ask Nancy Pelosi, what do you think this is? Like, what is important to you here? What was the rationale for why Ed Markey, who I have no special affection for, but is just a total normal, reliable Democratic vote in the Senate, never sinks proposals that the rest of the party is for? What was the need to replace him with Joseph Kennedy III, except that Joseph Kennedy III is rich and well-connected and a Kennedy? What was the point of that? What was the party going to gain through that substitution? And, you know, when it happened in 2020, in the midst of what Pelosi was justifiably telling us every day was like the most epical election in American history. And, you know, if that's the case, why are you diverting attention to helping this, you know, well-connected crony, you know, find a way to get a Senate position because that's what he wants to put on his resume? You know, what is the point of that? And too many of them think like that, what the old school Bush era blogger Jane Hampshire used to call the golden Rolodex. You know, the Democratic Party is just obsessed with how do we get, you know, make sure everybody who's in the club is rewarded whenever we have the opportunity to do so. That kind of stuff just isn't important to people.
But it's even worse than that. And this is where I'm really afraid of Hakeem Jeffries, actually, because of his link to AIPAC and AIPAC's link to a PAC that has sought to sink, and often successfully, to sink progressive voices in the party who actually do care about the interests of the voters. And I'm thinking, for example, of Nina Turner, who was favored to win until this AIPAC-funded PAC, and I don't remember the name, came in to sink her. And so they have really gone after progressives. Talk a bit about the progressives in the Democratic Party. What should they do? You say they need to follow the lessons of the DLC when they in gaining power. Talk about that dynamic.
Well, they're always going to be marginalized within the party because you have leadership and, you know, typified by someone like Hakeem Jeffries, who he sees his entire purpose, you know, his political reason for existing is to gatekeep the left, right? He would absolutely rather defeat the left and lose to the right than the other way around. And that's the mindset of way too many people who end up in leadership positions for the Democratic Party. It's something that's kind of a precondition for a leadership position, you know, sort of understanding that your job is to police people to the left of Mitt Romney, not to, you know, draw a line in the sand and fight to the death for your principles against your opponents who are trying to dismantle the country. So the rise of somebody like Jeffries to a leadership position, and again, there was no vote on this. It was just a coronation. The outgoing leader gets to handpick their successor. And that's, you know, what battles for leadership pass for in the Democratic Party. They like coronations. They don't like competition. And the ugliness of you know, ideological competition within the party is what ultimately, you know, makes it a more effective organization. And this idea that what we should always be seeking to do is run the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign, where, you know, there was no room for anything except absolute fealty. You either got on board and bowed down and accepted the inevitability of it, or you were the enemy. And that's just not a very effective way for a party to orient itself toward the world. The ascension of Jeffries to, you know, the speaker position, I think he's going to make us yearn for Pelosi. I don't know how long he's going to have the job based on, you know, past experience. He's probably got it for life now, and he's a young man. So you and I aren't going to live to see a different, you know, Democratic House leader. But, you know, nobody can explain what his qualification is for that position other than that he is deeply loyal to the principles that the previous leadership group have.
So it sounds like there's no hope.
Well, there's always hope. The point is, you can't keep doing the same things and expect the outcome to be different. So I don't encourage people to be hopeless and give up and not vote and all those kinds of deeply cynical things. I'm deeply cynical myself. I understand those impulses. But the thing is, what you have to be able to spot what's happening in real time and say, oh, okay, what they're doing here is a repeat of something they've done in the past and never works. Right. And you have to be able to expect and anticipate that when you're doing a failed strategy for the umpteenth time, failure is the likely outcome. And they're deeply invested in trying to stick to their ideological preferences and do the same things over and over, but explain to voters why this time it's going to be different. And one of the most trite things on the internet at this point is any sort of comment. You look in the replies on Facebook or whatever, and someone posts the cartoon picture of Lucy holding the football while Charlie Brown tries to kick it. I think that's overplayed. But there's also, you know, a lesson to be taken from that comic panel that you just cannot keep trusting these people to work with you in good faith over and over again. You know, we're about to have 6 months of debate about the debt ceiling that all could have been avoided if in December, you know, the president hadn't come out and said, no, eliminating the debt ceiling would be irresponsible. Let's work with the Republicans on this. You know, it's just self-inflicted wounds. You know exactly how this is going to play out.
Well, I guess I'd like to ask, yes, Hakeem Jeffries is going to police the left, but does that mean that the left has no power at all? I mean, after all, Hakeem Jeffries could be voted out with enough organizing. You do have an increase of progressives. They're not just a fringe. The progressive caucus is getting bigger and bigger. You know, you've got some hopeful signs in people like, what is his name? Maxwell from Florida.
You're not wrong. I agree with you. It's just going to take some time. And the question is, with the direction the Republican Party is heading in now, this hard anti-democratic turn they're taking, how much time do we have before it's too late? That's the dilemma that we keep running up against. There's absolutely hope. There is the ability that over time, or there's the potential that over time, the Progressive Caucus in the House will grow and gain more influence. That's what happens in politics, but it happens over a longer time frame than we're really comfortable dealing with at this point. I feel like we have some problems as a nation that are so pressing that, you know, the response from the institutional Democratic Party to the Dobbs decision, I think, is telling. Their attitude is, look, stay the course, keep voting blue, and in 20, 30, 40 years, we'll get the Supreme Court back. And people don't hear that and think that sounds like a good realistic strategy. They want something that's going to alleviate the suffering that that decision caused right now.
Well, the book is terrific. Chaotic Neutral, How the Democrats Lost Their Soul in the Center. Ed Bermilla, thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ed Bermilla writes for The Nation magazine and The Washington Post and hosts a podcast, Mass for Shut-Ins. Chaotic Neutral is out from Bold Type Books. Next up, Bootstrapped. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The American Dream says anyone can go from rags to riches by pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. But it's a cruel myth that Alyssa Quart of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project explodes in her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. I spoke with her back in January, but the book just came out this month. Let's hear our conversation. Alyssa Quart, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you, Francesca. Happy to be here.
Bootstrapped has a subtitle, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Why do we have to liberate ourselves from the American Dream?
I was fascinated by the original American Dream, which was James Truslow Adams and his 1931 book on the subject. And his American Dream was to be more appealing. It was communitarian and less individualistic. It was the dream we need. But somehow over the course of the 20th century, it became this thing that we have to do entirely on our own. We, you know, have to find our careers on our own. We have to sustain our families and our health and our educations on our own. We have to care for our children on our own. And, you know, we have to make our country work on our own, you know, help our fellow citizens on our own, even like that we can't count on others to help others either. So to me, I want to reclaim this American dream. And so first, though, we need to liberate ourselves from the hackneyed one that we live with.
Yeah, you call it a toxic ideology, this ideology of bootstrapping. So connect bootstrapping, first of all, where did the notion, even the term, come from, and connect it to the American dream?
Sure. So I'm looking at a bunch of different terms. There's the term self-made man, and that was coined in the 1830s by Representative Henry Clay from a slave state, where he was using it to praise his state's manufacturers, which of course is kind of comical that their patient and diligent labor when they were obviously dependent on a whole host of unpaid workers, you know, who are unwilling workers who are enslaved. And then the term bootstraps was similarly odd in its origin. It was started out as a kind of absurdity or a joke. It was very hard for people to put on their boots in the 19th century, and they had servants or machines that helped them do it if they were wealthy. And if they were poor, they just struggled to pull them up. They had these little tabs on the side of the boots. You know, I think there are a few boots that still have them, right? Like the little tabs on the side where you pull it on. And it was a real fundament of being a working man, right? You have to have these boots to do a day's work, right? So it was important to pull yourself up, pull your bootstraps on. Now, pulling yourself up was even more impossible because it was sort of like, I kept imagining it, it was sort of like putting on a ski while you're in bed or something like that. And somehow over the decades, it went from being a joke. It was used as a joke even by like metaphysicians in the early 19th century, like the proverbial bootstraps, right? It was kind of a joke, to being this thing taken so seriously, like, oh, this is something that we all must do. We all must, you know, make ourselves, make our luck, make our success in this way.
Yeah, and talking about metaphysicians of the 19th century, you criticize some of our greatest cultural icons. I mean, I had no idea that folks like the Transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau, were such great champions of this notion of the, you know, the rugged individualist, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I'm going to probably get a lot of scholars who come out of the woodwork eager, you know, to challenge hidebound scholars, because, I mean, their idea of self-reliance was also, you know, reliance, you know, independence of the church, independence of conformity, right? There were sort of more noble ways in which they were asking people to be self-reliant, more that was truly about independent thought, right? But there is an element, some of the, if you look at the language they use, that they were telling people that they needed to live on their own. You know, Thoreau, you know, was right. He spent his supposed isolation in Walden Pond. And when you look into it, he was actually at, you know, joyous social gatherings that would make anyone during COVID really jealous. And, you know, similarly, Emerson was arguing for this total self-reliance while he himself was very bourgeois and kind of suing his ex-wife, widow, she had passed away, her estate to have support for him and the Transcendentalists. So the idea that we're all utterly autonomous was not supported by their biographies. And even the things that they sort of, they're kind of commonplace beliefs that they, the way they live.
You know, I mean, Thoreau, I love the story that his mother came out to his little cottage every week to do his laundry. And actually talk about women as the, you know, huge, often subterranean resource, unrecognized resource that so many of these self-made men are dependent on.
Yeah, I mean, I found this incredible passage where, like, Lydian, who was Emerson's second wife, did every inch of cooking and cleaning of the farm and the house. And then in one instance, she had done this massive cleaning, and the next day she gave birth. So this was the this independence of mind rested on the shoulders of people like Lydian as well.
And Laura Ingalls Wilder of the Little House on the Prairie fame, you actually go kind of deeply into her life. I mean, she was almost like the, you know, the forerunner of Ayn Rand in some ways.
She really was. I mean, she was her and her daughter, Rose, were conservative libertarians, and they hated FDR. And the series, the Little House series, because it was a book of 8 books that has, I think, to date sold like 60 million copies. It was published from 1932 to 1943. So these are really crucial years of social programs and interdependence, the sort of opposite of the things that Little House on the Prairie was championing, like farmers operating on their own without any support from anyone, which, of course, I can get into, was not true. They were getting money through the Homestead Act. They were getting land through the Homestead Act. But yeah, they attended this as an attack on FDR and like a kind of stealth support for Herbert Hoover, who used the term rugged individualist. I think he may have even coined it. He used it frequently. And they saw their books as part of that fight for the rugged individualist in American life and politics. I'm not going to lie, it's pretty attractive when you're a child reading these books. You know, I remember the maple syrup poured on the snow. That was the great treat for them, you know. But this was, we have a dictator, Wilder's daughter wrote of Roosevelt in her journal, saying she'd like to kill the traitor. And she really saw the book as an argument against, you know, the New Deal and other governmental assistance programs that arose at that time, and commented the government was too intrusive, that taxes were part of the swift and violent death of democracy.
Well, she'd probably be running for office in today's GOP.
Her and Sarah Huckabee Sanders might have a lot in common, you know? Yeah.
Talking about these forerunners, or these, not for the foundations of our notion of bootstrapping, you also talk about Charles Darwin, and you point out that the idea of survival of the fittest as this kind of individualized icon or ideal is only one part of the story. Talk about the other part.
Yeah, I mean, I found this whole group called socialist Darwinists. So you may be familiar with the phrase social Darwinists. Like, that came out of around the time that Darwin lived and died. A group of British intellectuals started to treat him as if he was like a progenitor of this kind of, not even eugenics, but yeah, survival of the fittest, this kind of gladiatorial sense of social theory, not just about animals, about human beings, right? Socialist Darwinists see Darwin as the opposite. And they say things like Darwin was not an individualist, that he was all about interdependence. And I think that was really interesting when I went back and looked at some of Darwin's writing. I mean, he uses the phrase mutual sympathy. He talks about how the mistletoe goes around trees symbiotically, like the mistletoe is a parasite, and it it depends on the trees to exist, you know, the bugs that were on the birds' backs, the ants in their farms, the small fish that are help clean the larger fish, you know, and other beasts that were super cooperative, and even polyps, you know, which are these teeny cellular creatures, you know, they act it by one movement. So he saw it as, I love this phrase, a manifestation of sociability, and that they all share and they all have a desire to communicate. So I guess a lot of this book is a rereading of the classics. That was quite fun, that part of it.
Yeah, and of course, it's not just that. You really do go into how this toxic ideology has underpinned so much of injustice in our system. You know, it's so ironic that as we're talking, we listen to Joe Biden's second State of the Union address, and one would think that we're still the shining city on the hill, but we have always had that dark underbelly, and that shining city, just like the American dream, has been a myth that's been used to cover up so much that is wrong with our society, you know, a burden that really other societies don't have quite to the same degree. I mean, if we think about, say, the so-called socialism of the Scandinavian countries, I mean, we're just the worst country in the world when it comes to among its peers of industrialized nations for the social safety net. So this really manifests in what you call the just world hypothesis, which is a kind of a fever dream that so many Americans subscribe to.
Yeah. So, you know, the just world hypothesis was developed by a social psychologist named Melvin Lerner in the mid-60s. And it's this idea that we all have, or many of us have, that what happens to people is what they deserve. And it helped me understand this idea of the undeserving poor, which is obviously a terrible social lie that we're being told, but also the deserving rich, that if we're successful and wealthy in this country, there's some understanding that somehow we deserve this state. And it's not that 60% of wealth is inherited, which is the truth. So I don't know if people deserve their own inheritance, but that is what the just world hypothesis that we live with sort of helps us believe. And Lerner did these social experiments in the 60s that were, you know, Stanley Milgram, who did that experiment, that famous experiment in California, to see if people would give other people shocks. Well, this is sort of similar. There's a young woman who is in behind a screen and looking as if she's in great suffering and looking like she's getting shocks. And actually, she was an actor. And all the people who were gathered around behind the screen watching this woman were supposed to say whether she deserved it or not. And they tended to think she did. That when the students were given a range of instructions, you know, did she get what she deserved? And they believe she did. And he read this to support his idea of the just world. It helps our systems of value appear stable and orderly. Like, it gives a sense of determinism. Okay, she's in pain. She's being made to suffer because she did something wrong.
I used to be a social worker. So in the history of social work, it began with, you know, the deserving poor, which would be white widows. Anybody else was the undeserving poor. So, of course, there's been a whole racial aspect to this as well. And, you know, the cracks in this idea became crevices when the pandemic hit. Talk about the impact of the pandemic on this notion of bootstrapping.
Well, I think it was pretty clear when 40% of U.S. workers said they had experienced worsening job quality since the start of COVID-19, right? That things had gotten much worse for people who had to go to work, people who were on the front lines, as they called them initially, you know, retail workers, meatpacking workers, and there was a lot fewer protections than people expected. Like, subjects of my book who were Lyft drivers. Nobody was giving them masks or sanitizer, or, you know, they were waiting for these companies to give them hazard pay or, you know, other protections. And it just never arrived. And they were, as one of the writers of my in my organization put it, they were curbside delivery. They were human beings who were that. And it was hard not to see the society as incredibly tiered, especially as there were record profits from some of the biggest companies. And, you know, it was opportunistic, really. They were benefiting from COVID. Another thing that happened, and I talk about this in my book, where people were having to go to GoFundMe to support their medical care during COVID. So we saw, like, not only people on the front lines as workers being sort of hung out to dry, but we saw people who actually were sick not getting adequate support. And so we're in it on our own. We're supposed to survive on our own. There's a lot of talk about who was essential and who wasn't, but ultimately that fell away too, and things went back to normal. And companies, you know, these companies were still crushing their unions, like Uber and other giants like that. So not unions, but they were crushing workers who were trying to unionize. So I think that that was the story. And I think I described it as like an ultraviolet ray that exposed the social discrepancies.
Yeah. You know, people may say, well, you know, COVID medical care was free. Well, it wasn't. If you lost your job, you could only get free care if you were hospitalized with COVID, not for anything else. And there was so much else that is involved with getting medical care for COVID that was not covered. So, you know, I think a lot of us thought, oh, they've got to pass Medicare for all now, you know, when it's so obvious in a pandemic that you need to have universal health care. But we're going backwards.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, there's this kind of mindset, especially amongst the very wealthy, but the upper middle class as well. I mean, and I probably had some of this too, but that we would have like a private castle of quarantine, you know, that it was like with drawbridges where you'd get people delivering to you and you would never put yourself in this space where you'd be endangered. And it's sort of obviously the opposite of being worker-centered. And yeah, it showed us the order of things. And also, I mean, another thing I write about is we had to depend on an army of volunteers. There was a guy named Armin Henderson and his collaborators and other people who were making masks. And I talked to them early on in the pandemic about how they were doing this work, how they were, you know, giving people COVID tests, how they were creating masks for hospital workers. And this was all, they were doing it all for free, you know, on their own initiative. But that's just another expectation that we're going to have all these people gathering like an army, a volunteer army to support people when they need it.
Yes. In fact, I was one of the people who was sewing masks for frontline workers here. And you call this a kind of dystopian social safety net. I mean, not entirely, because we will talk about mutual aid, and I think it is a very important part of it. Yet the more salient point is that this kind of volunteerism was necessary because the government, to whom we pay burdensome taxes, was really not there for us, even with the stimulus plan. And that support was taken away just as soon as possible.
Yeah. And again, back to Armin Henderson, you know, he was giving people COVID tests early in the pandemic, and he was a Black doctor. He is a Black doctor. And he said he felt honor bound to treat this unhoused population during this time, because who else was going to do it? And I think that sense is simultaneously, and that's why I call it the dystopian social net, it's inspiring in the sense that it's like enough people believe in mutualism and interdependence and dependence that we can make a difference on that level. And it's really depressing that we have to be thrown back on the resources of someone like Armin Henderson, who was, after he finished his work at the hospital, then ran out to help people on the streets of Miami. And I speak to many people in this book who are doing things that are simultaneously inspiring and depressing like that, you know, started mutual aids in my neighborhood and in different parts of the country. I talked to a number of people who did that. people who are doing participatory budgeting, where they're participating in their municipal government, trying to redirect the money, how the money is spent in their cities. And again, this is all volunteer.
And I wanted to go back. You talk in this book, Alyssa Court, in Bootstrapped, you show that it was in counties. Now I need to find it here.
Yeah, in counties where, this is in the Laura Ingalls Wilder chapter, there was counties that were most, that were reflected the rugged individualism and were like pioneer counties in the West that had the worst rates of adherence to public health strictures and during COVID, right? Is that the study?
Yes, exactly.
I found that fascinating. I was like, wow, this is deep history. This is like, yeah, this is deep social history.
Well, I mean, it's like the fact that as the pandemic went on, more and more of the proportion of people who were Trump voters and GOP were went up of those who had higher mortality rates, which really underscores. I mean, I can remember during the pandemic, people refusing to wear their mask and me trying to say to people, you know, this is to keep us all safe and healthy. We have to take care of each other. And it was like I was talking a foreign language.
Yeah. So this was a study published in March 2022 that found the most individualistic counties in the U.S. were formerly frontier areas. And I found that just like totally fascinating. It was economist Samuel Bazzi, among others, who found the counties with the greater total frontier experience, and they call it TFE, during the era of westward expansion, had the weakest response to public health risks, and that there was like kind of a historical unconscious that was bubbling forth during COVID. I mean, and if anything, it's like, to me, this gave me extra energy to go into the historical problems here and how this try to myth bust, because the power of the myth is not just inert. It's not history's always with us, right? It's not just a funny artifact. The belief in Laura Ingalls Wilder, the belief in these rags to riches stories and Herbert Hoover's kind of rhetoric from the 20s lingers.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And also the administrative burden that you talk about. It struck me the other day that, you know, the pandemic is being declared over, even though upwards of 500 people are dying every day because of it, still. And that's going to mean that in order to qualify for Medicaid, you're going to have to start re-qualifying again, you know, every, I don't know how many times a year. Talk about the impact of this administrative burden, how this expresses the idea of the undeserving poor, and what the impact is on people.
Yeah, so I mean, the administrative burden was something that has interested me. And actually, I produced a radio program called Going for Broke that had two seasons. And one of the season, an episode was devoted to this burden. There was a subject who had tried to apply for unemployment money for her father, who was first gen and couldn't fill out the forms. His Spanish and his general like lack of comfort in navigating social services held him back. So she spent hours and hours trying to help him get unemployment money. This was during COVID, during the height of the pandemic. And it started me thinking about this administrative burden, time tax that so many people have to put in to get basic services. So, you know, they call it a take-up rate. A take-up rate suggests how hard getting aid can be. So it means what percentage of people who can get SNAP or Medicaid actually get it. And SNAP is food stamps. And for SNAP, the national take-up rate is 82%, but it can be as low as 52% in some states. That means that almost half the people who are eligible do not receive it. And usually it's because they don't understand how to navigate the social services. And the reason they don't understand, again, is not that they're undeserving or dullards. It's because it was inscribed in the very construction of these programs. They were made hard to access. And if you compare them, and I sort of started doing this, I was going through, you know, how do you apply for SNAP and Medicaid versus how you apply for Social Security, right? Social Security goes to many older white people and older white men, right? It's incredibly easy. It's incredibly easy to get Social Security. It's like a screen or two versus recertifying, you know, multiple times. You know, you have to bring all your materials sometimes. You know, you have to say how much you spent on stuffed animals. I spoke to someone who had to say this, you know, to get recertified for social, for welfare or Medicaid. And so I think this is the stuff that we need to look at. Like, why do we make it so hard? And it's more costly. It creates levels of like a liberal leviathan or like administrative burden, in a sense, for our government, too. That's more expensive than if there were like a couple of welfare cheats that snuck in, right? And I was even thinking of writing something about this, the gift of the pandemic, because there was something about what happened around social services during the pandemic. People couldn't come into the office. They let go of this interview process to get, they also had eviction moratorium, right? So there's a whole army of people who were less active trying to evict people from their homes. So I think that was very positive. Like, what can we learn from that? And this is all part of my theory, which is called the art of dependence, where I think actually getting these services is like a huge skill. You know, when I talk to people who work to get the services they need, it's like, I have trouble filling out, you know, forms for my kids' summer camp. I have trouble filling out forms in the doctor's office. You know what I mean? And these are people whose whole life is comprised of this. And thinking what would they be capable of if you liberated some of that energy from that this process.
And that's that's where I was going next. In fact, you say the art of interdependence is the foundation of life, because you really call it interdependence. I mean, this is the whole idea. It isn't that we should depend on others and just get given to. It's that we all give to everyone.
Yeah, and but I think art of dependence in some ways is more provocative because, yeah, it's interdependence, it's mutualism, but it is also dependence. Like, we're all, 1 in 4 of us are disabled. If we live long enough to be old, we're all going to be in a state of dependence. And it's not going to be interdependence, it's going to be dependence. And I was just reading something beautiful by Alice Wong, who's a disability activist, who wrote a book that just came out. She's, you know, at this point, she can't even speak. She's, you know, eating through a tube. You know, she has some terrible neurological disease. And she was just writing about this, about how important it is to appreciate in some ways the capacity to be dependent and to have these relationships with her caregivers and to, but also she was writing about how hard it was to navigate these systems. She's had to create a patchwork of private and public care for herself. She has 24-hour care. People don't show up, you know, and she's, you know, unable to, I guess, get out of bed without help. But part of being the art of interdependence or dependence, however you want to slice it, is indeed the skill and craft it takes to lean on others. That is the administrative burden, you know, the skill and craft it takes to get services, but it's also the skill and craft it takes to be part of a mutual aid, to set up a remote learning situation with your kids, to actually acknowledge how others have helped us. I mean, that's where I end. And I think in some ways, that's just kind of like a psychological thing that a lot of us have to do. We're, instead of saying, I wrote this book, I could say, the 20 people who helped me edit this and talked it through with me, you know, the designer friends who looked at the cover and said, oh, it should be blue, not green. Literally, this is an example. And that, so even authorship is a collective practice.
That's beautiful. That's really a beautiful place, I think, to end. But in the few minutes that we do have left, just bring it home for us. How do we get there? How do we get to the new American dream?
So I outline a number of ways that I think we should be going with this, including these smaller, they might seem bespoke, like these mutual aid setups or the workers' cooperatives where workers are owners and workers at the same time. But I also think in our political life, we need to start electing people who don't partake in the self-made myth. And we need to start running candidates who are open about their own vulnerability. And I was very struck recently by Maxwell Alejandro Frost, who, you know, was Southern Florida representative who admitted that he couldn't afford to rent an apartment in Washington, D.C. AOC had also done that. And I thought, wow, this is great. This is what a lot of Americans, most Americans' lives are like. And this guy is admitting to this and then admitting he's going to live in his friend's house in the meanwhile, or multiple friends' houses while he's waiting for his, you know, they're paid pretty well. They're paid $174,000 representatives, but he is not wealthy, working class, person of color, moving there, had no savings. Like, this is going to be a while till he makes enough to get such an apartment, right? So just the fact that he acknowledged that, I was like, and this goes us back to the State of the Union. It's get us out of this like Horatio Alger possibility, whatever. Let's talk about vulnerability as part of this too. Because I think vulnerability and also pride in survival, as opposed to pride in being a rags to riches miracle.
Alyssa Court, it's a terrific book and it's really a great read. Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. It's been great talking with you about it. Thank you.
Oh yeah, thank you so much.
In addition to Bootstrapped, Alyssa Court is the author of four other nonfiction books, including Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. She's also the author of two books of poetry, Thoughts and Prayers, and Monetized. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.